IVM.
Welcome to All Things Policy, a daily podcast supported by Pragati, a flagship media initiative of the Takshashila Institution. We're a bunch of policy nerds based in Bengaluru, and we like to bring a fresh perspective to Indian affairs and an Indian perspective to global affairs. So grab a cup of coffee, sit back, and join us for today's chat.
Hello and welcome to another episode of All Things Policy. I am Saurabh Todi and I have with me my colleagues Aditya Ramanath and Manoj Kemal Ramani. Today we will talk about the need to have a proper declassification system of Indian archives and records and how lack of it has impacted the quality of research and prohibits a more holistic and a well-rounded review of our history, especially in post-independence India. So welcome, Aditya, and welcome, Manoj.
Hey, thank you.
Hey, Saurabh, great to join you.
So, I mean, we have this myth that have been, you know, like, created around, you know, the Indian, like, policy that, you know, Indians lack strategic culture or that, you know, India was mainly occupied with Pakistan and did not focus that much on China, in at least in its few certain decades of independence, or that, you know, that Indians don't understand force or like they don't really see it as an instrument of statecraft. So all of this, the narratives are the result of, you know, the observations by scholars from, you know, like the West and mainly foreign sources. And so the one argument is that these the narratives are sustained because like India has not had a proper system of declassifying its records and the access to archives is also very limited. There is not much digitization or the fact that, you know, the condition of these archives is not that good. And then there have been some instances where old records have been mislabeled and then even destroyed. So, Manoj, what do you see are the problems currently with the system or the lack of a declassification system in India?
Hey, so, I mean, I think fundamentally, as somebody who studies China, I would say that one of the biggest challenges is the fact that we don't necessarily have a sound policy with regard to declassification. We don't have necessarily clarity on, you know, and this is not just necessarily an Indian phenomenon. It's a, you know, in most parts of the world that you will go, you will hear academics and scholars and even policy analysts basically say, and actually even folks in government say that everybody tends to overclassify everything. And there's a lot of sort of need to make sure that that doesn't happen. In terms of the sort of state of declassification, I think the fact is that there are lots of things with regard to China which say still remain classified, right? A lot of our material with regard to the 1962 war remains classified. A lot of the sort of lead up to the war also. A lot of, say, the Henderson Brooks report, which is extremely popular and everybody knows it. It is technically declassified, but, you know, it's obviously available in the public domain for those who really want to go and find it. So the challenge is that you need to have political commitment, you need to have clear policy which says that you will declassify relevant materials unless any, and your sort of definition of what impinges on national security needs to become much more narrow and much more precise. And you need to make it a policy where within a specified period of time, content gets declassified. And for that, I think it's important that there is political will. There is also bureaucratic capacity that you will need to do that because you'll need to actually staff people who can go through the documentation, who can make sure what is of what classification and then accordingly declassify. And that's sort of the system that you need to put in place, right? The challenge is also that I think in general, if you look at, say, how the Indian system has responded to the RTI, it doesn't leave me terribly optimistic about, you know, there being this great new sort of enthusiasm for declassification of old documents. Also the fact that history continues, and again, this is not unique to India, but history continues to be a critical battleground in current day politics. You will likely see much more sort of caution on declassification. So even if you have a policy which says that in X number of years, you're going to declassify certain kinds of content, the definition and the arbitrariness of those definitions will remain very, very large. So to me, that is a structural problem that needs to be addressed. But yeah, it's in the interest of the policy ecosystem and the scholarly community and practitioners to encourage and push for greater declassification and greater transparency.
Aditya, like how easy it is to, you know, like if I am a research scholar in, let's say, a tier two town studying history or in World War One, World War Two, or even India's foreign policy post-independence, and I don't have many connections with the MPs or MLAs or someone in Delhi, how easy it is for me to get access? I mean, is that also a big concern where it is few people who can access these documents, or at least they have the connections which allow them to have that permission?
Yeah, so I you're right. I think if what you're suggesting, Saurabh, is that it is generally hard to access the archives, I think that perception is correct. Now, of course, it depends on which archives you are trying to access. So as Manoj said, a lot of, you know, archival access is blocked in India simply because politics is a battleground. So if you want to access the archives in NMML, if you generally want to access archives relating to post-independence India, and certainly India after the say about 1960 onwards, it's going to be harder, and they're basically going to be more hoops for you to jump through. If you want to, on the other hand, research something pre-independence, typically, depending on the archive, it tends to be a little easier. But you still need some, you need to jump through some hoops. You do need to present some credentials, explain what your motivations are. Now, I'm a little torn on this subject because I do think that some of this access needs to be democratized. But having said that, a lot of archives, Saurabh, are in very, very fragile condition. And I think it makes sense for us to insist that people who do research in these places have serious purposes, and also that they will, hopefully handle archival material with some degree of care. Now, those are not guaranteed even if you are some PhD scholar at an Ivy League university, but it's nice to have, I think, some rules for this. And certainly there have to be rules about how documents can be handled and so on. Now, there's one simple way, of course, in which governments can actually democratize access to archives without endangering the documents themselves, which is, to basically put them up online, digitize them and make them available to everyone. So even if you're in a tier two city, you don't have to come to Delhi to the National Archives of India. Now, of course, actually digitizing lots of archives in India is going to be a multi-decade process, most likely, because archives are huge. These are really massive stacks of government documents, of pouring correspondence on all sorts of issues. So that's a process that's going to take a while. But as far as the question of India, not having this cultural tradition of making archives accessible, I'll just modify that statement. I'll say that it's always been political in the sense that once something ceases to be politically explosive, archives do tend to open up, at least to some people. And we've seen this really, you can see this really when you start going back to Indian history, really from the 18th century onwards, because by the late 19th century and early 20th century, for example, when a lot of the politics of the expansion of the East India Company in the 18th century is not such a political hot potato anymore, you start seeing a lot of path-breaking research being done on the diplomatic and military history of that period. You start seeing collections being made, being published and, thereby at least theoretically accessible to others. The Peshwa Daftar records, the G.S. Sardesai put together, the calendar of Persian correspondence, English factory records. Jadunath Sarkar, had put together English records and Persian records of Mount Thai history. Then even for somewhat more sensitive topics like the mutiny or rebellion of 1857, 58, you had compilations like G.W. Forrest's and so on. So it does happen eventually. And you've seen that after independence with the, you know, selected works of Nehru, with writings of Ambedkar, with the works of Gandhi. All of these are now compiled. In fact, all of these can now be accessed online. They are available to anyone who wants to go and look at them. So there is, I think, a kind of tradition here, but politics holds a veto over this. And sometimes, you know, you do hear, you know, the standard response to not declassifying is something along the lines of, well, you know, it's prejudicial to foreign relations or national security and so on. So, you know, the simple test case for that is, well, firstly, other countries do it. So are they not concerned about their national security or their foreign relations? But also, let's, you know, the three of us over here tend to be more interested in that stuff, you know, foreign relations. But let's, for example, ask for the archives of the Union government in 1982 to be released so we can understand decision-making behind the Asian Games, you know, of that year. I assume that's not going to be very complicated, not very controversial, right? So I think we can just throw up some test cases like this and maybe probe the government and ask, you know, why you're not ready to declassify these things.
Yeah, so I mean, in that case, I mean, that's true. I guess it has to do with politics. We also saw that the Netaji papers also were like declassified a few years ago. That's because, you know, it was all politics as well. So, I mean, in this case, I mean, do you think that, Manoj, like, what is the role of private sector in this? I mean, we do have certain, you know, like for example, the Bhandarkar Oriental Research Institute has, like, some archives, and you have the Ashoka University's, like, archives of contemporary India. And then there are a few other examples where the private papers of leaders and the PMs have been published. So is that the way to go, in the sense that if there is not enough push by the government due to various reasons, can this be one way, or is this also then just trying to push the can down the road?
Yeah, look, I mean, it's great that there are certain private collections, and it's really wonderful that some of those get open to public and open to researchers. But that also happens, often that happens selectively, but not always. And sometimes that will not be the case, right? Where a private collection may just not be open to anybody unless, say, it passes hands to the government or something like that. So I don't think that would be the way to go, because at the end of the day, anything that may be that may end up being deemed as sensitive by the government, and you've got the Official Secrets Act. So you will end up seeing the government essentially having a say in some of these things, particularly when something may be deemed as sensitive. So the challenge essentially becomes about what is deemed as sensitive or critical to national security and that sort of stuff, right? So that's, I think, so the government will always have a role to play. And I don't think you can see, you know, the private sector in India sort of become the flag bearer in this case. It is great if private collections are opened up to researchers and people at large with due care and due sort of care taken with regard to access, like Aditya had talked about. But at the end of the day, to me, this is going to be a matter of public policy where the government has to take a call, and the government has to start nurturing a culture where there is, you know, standards set, where there is shrinking of the idea of what is sensitive, and you are more open to having transparent conversations about past and about policy making in the past. And it's important for policymakers in India to see this from the prism of how the past can inform better policy making in the future, rather than thinking of it from the perspective of political debates in the current sort of environment. For example, you spoke about the Netaji papers. For years and years and years, we've seen this sort of, in some ways, this strange conspiratorial cult built around, you know, Subhash Chandra Bose. And greater transparency would have always made it easier, you know, at least for some of the wildest of rumors that we heard about him to not be spread. And you would have ended up having a much more informed conversation about his contribution, his views, his life, as opposed to what we have seen in the last how many ever number of years around him and the controversies. It's at the end of the day, at the government level, it's important to have a much more sort of policy-oriented view on this than political view on this. Secondly, as a society, it would be better if we were, and again, I'm talking sort of very ideal situation. As a society, it would be better if we were willing to be much more transparent about our past and have honest conversations about them, rather than sort of, you know, half-baked, half-in-half sort of partly informed conspiratorial WhatsApp conversations. And to for all of that, to me, having the archives open, having a better declassification is helpful, right? So that you can actually have informed debates about why certain decisions were taken. Often what we have seen is that whenever, you know, even the most sort of controversial things that we have thought about, whenever they are declassified, you know, the sky does not fall, you know. And I think it's just overly sensitive approaches that governments have tended to have. And again, this is not just about India, even in other parts of the world, where people will say the exact same thing that, look, we are overly cautious about some of these things. None of this is going to change. The sky will not fall. It's important to have transparent conversations to understand why we got to where we have gotten.
Thank you. So I was curious that, you know, like with all the talk that we have, I mean, and we've had this refrain for many years now, even decades, that, you know, like our story, the Indian story is not heard, our version of events are not heard, or, you know, like we, even for research, Indian scholars have to rely on Western sources of events regarding India. So to me, it's actually very curious that while we complain about the fact that our story is not told, the steps that we need to take to allow that to happen, we don't seem to take them, or at least there is not enough appetite within the government, the armed forces, and the whole institutions that, you know, like as you say, like sunlight is the best trace infected, right? So like the more you open up archives, the more people will be able to research, and they'll be able to have a much better idea, a much more informed debate, and maybe some other insights that we may not know until those archives are declassified. So Aditya, like, do you think that, I mean, I was also thinking that for like certain issues, I mean, let's say like regarding wars, regarding, you know, political decisions, such as, let's say, the 65 war, 62 war, you know, like Siachen issue, and then nuclear test, you know, all of these are such major events which, like, based on which certain narratives, true or not true, is debatable, are pushed because we don't have any alternative, right? Like we can't say, I mean, so do you think that declassifying things would actually help, you know, like bringing India's like viewpoint to the world, and then especially like now that, you know, we are becoming a more active player on the global stage, we need to know like what our strengths and weaknesses are. As Mahamanov said, that until we have a dispassionate analysis of those strengths and weaknesses, we risk repeating those mistakes.
Yeah, so I mean, I don't think that we should think of it as somehow protecting India's national interest, because, you know, ultimately history is what it is, and historians will use those archives and come to conclusions that will be inconvenient to many people, including many people in India, right? Really, one of the big reasons why archives are not declassified in the first place. But really, I mean, I agree that if we want to obviously learn where we went wrong, how we came to decisions, how we reacted to situations better, we need all the information we can get. And it's great that we have other foreign archival sources, because that is absolutely part of what we do, part of what you need to piece that together. But it would be great to have more access to India's own archives, because, you know, that would give us a more fine-grained sense of how Indians were reacting, how Indians were behaving to specific situations. And, you know, the conclusions from that will be whatever historians draw, and also whatever readers draw. It's the idea is not to, you know, put out an Indian point of view. The idea is to simply open it up and let people make their own decisions. The idea is really open it up to scholarship, and eventually, you know, you will get something out of it that is useful. So, yeah, I think that's the way we have to approach it. Like Manoj said, it has to be policy oriented rather than politics oriented.
You know, just let me add this one little bit. This idea that, you know, some of these fears, right, you know, that having more access to archives and classified material being declassified will lead to sort of, I mean, it's important to think that it will give you information, but interpretations and narrative creation will still happen, you know, because different people will approach the same facts from very different prisms. And they will also add different layers to their arguments. For example, and we were talking about this before we started recording, there have been a bunch of books recently on the 1962 war between India and China. And you will see the same set of information treated quite differently. And that's because the authors are looking at the decision makers who took decisions at that time from very different prisms. They are trying to put themselves within the shoes of those decision makers. Some are looking at a wider strategic plane. Some are looking at a narrower plane within this context of India and China. And they're arriving at very different sort of conclusions with some commonalities because the facts have become clearer. So what it does is that it at least grounds your conversation about the past within a certain factual base. And then you can disagree. Somebody may say that Nehru was very myopic in how he thought about China, or he was extremely romantic about how he thought about Asian solidarity, and that led to him taking multiple decisions which were faulty. While others might say that, look, while that was there, that he might have been myopic, it's not like he didn't think that force was not necessary, because he did take certain decisions to try and make sure that Arunachal was secure and so on and so forth. And we are only able to have this conversation and its complexity when we actually have those facts. That does not mean you're excusing errors of the past or you're sort of glorifying somebody. It just means that you're trying to appreciate the complexity within which history unfolded, and you're basing that in facts, as opposed to, unfortunately, what we have is, you know, WhatsApp forwards. So if we can do that through declassification, it creates an informed polity, which is what we end up needing.
Yeah, Manoj, you got it exactly right. Basically, if we want to have a quality debate, we need to have access to information and to data. And that does mean opening up the archives. I'll just add that, you know, obviously, we are talking here about diplomatic relations and conflicts. And that, you know, is obviously primarily focused on the workings of government and, you know, a few individuals. And so, you know, a lot of these archives we're talking about are, you know, government archives. But, you know, there are also private papers, as you both mentioned. And, you know, there's other sources. For example, you can do oral history later. You know, oral history obviously has its own limitations, you know, because people forget things, people can lie and so on. But you can do oral histories, you can pick up memoirs and all that. And you can use those along with multiple archives to create broader, perhaps more accurate picture, or at least a richer picture of what actually happened. Now, I'll just add that, you know, what Manoj said about having different interpretations, part of the reason for that is, you know, is also simply because archives are not the whole truth. You know, archives are just what is stored. You know, sometimes decisions are made, you know, in the corridors when people are having a smoke, and that may not be recorded in the archives, which is why we need to look at different sources, and which is why ultimately history will always be contested. And that's okay, so long as that contestation makes some sense and it's based on the facts that we actually have.
So yeah, so I mean, I completely agree. I mean, that's true. It's like, you know, like you need to see multiple archives, multiple sources to then piece together, you know, what was what actually happened. So like Manoj, like even for the 62 war example, I mean, the fact that you know, India has important documents or correspondence from that period still classified, and China has at least released a few of them. Although, like, selectively, I mean, that does feed into this broader narrative that, you know, like, even the books say that, you know, the few books that are being published now, that it seems that we were caught unawares, or like we were very confused. So the fact that we have not released, we have not declassified our documents, I mean, that does, I mean, it also plays for politics, right? Because then, at least in terms of like scholars, how much ever dispassionate one is, but when you don't have the documents of the other side to corroborate what one side is assuming or hinting at in their papers, I mean, that does add to, you know, like this idea that, you know, like it was all hunky-dory in China, and then they knew for what they were doing while we had no idea where we were going. So in a way, like, it's a mix of both facts and also how those facts and archives can be used also to further a kind of a narrative, especially for these crucial issues like wars and all.
Yeah, look, I mean, in the specific case of China, I think that it's really important to realize that Chinese sort of declassification processes, is generally extremely strict. You don't end up getting access to too many things. You know, it's strict at a policy level, yet at sort of local levels, you know, you may end up stumbling into an archive where there is a guard and he doesn't know too much, and you will just go in and you will get access to certain documentation. That will not be around, say, things like wars and all that, but there is sort of documentation that you may get access to with regard to, say, internal functionings of the party, economic policies and things like that. And the book by Frank Decatur on China's economic sort of development after Mao's death is based on declassified or classified documents basically available in the Chinese archives across the country in different places. So you may end up getting that, but otherwise, you know, at this level, the declassification is extremely strategic. You are thinking through things, you are thinking through a narrative of history that you want to project, and therefore you're declassifying or putting out material in that. So, I mean, Beijing functions that way. And I think it's important for, you know, us to realize that it functions that way. To me, that's not something that is going to, you know, there will be aspects of it which scholars will pick up and they will gain from, but it's not necessarily something that anybody will look at and say, this is the entire picture from the Chinese side of what the conversation was happening within the party at that point of time. And increasingly, this has gotten reinforced, as sort of the closing of China started to take place from 2008-2009 onwards. And under Xi Jinping, history is intensely political. You know, there is tremendous aspects of Chinese decision making in the 50s, 60s, not just with regard to India, but with regard to, you know, the Great Leap Forward, the Cultural Revolution, which remains in lock and key. We still don't know. So as a country, I think as a scholar approaching some of that material, I think it's useful. I think it's important. It can add value. But you need to be cognizant that it is a political agenda that has led to certain outcomes. It is not a policy process by which you want transparent data. And I think scholars who are to study that should also be factoring some of that into their assessments as to why certain things get declassified, at least when it comes to matters of such significance. But again, if you have a document which makes sense and which sort of helps you understand the complexity of decision making, it's always extremely useful. But it's useful to keep in mind why that's happened. From an Indian point of view, I honestly think that, you know, would it have helped if India had put out more material about its decision making? Of course, yes, around the 1962 war. But did it fundamentally sort of change the narrative around the war? I don't think so. You know, I think the narrative, at least in India, has remained fairly consistent throughout the decades, or at least in my sort of living memory, it's been very similar. It is about Chinese perfidy, around, you know, Indian political and Indian political sort of leadership's incompetence or an inability to comprehend the threat. You know, in particular, a lot of blame is laid on Nehru, and obviously the fact that the military was unprepared and it was given an a task where it was unprepared and we didn't sort of do. So I think those are the things that have consistently stayed, and these continue to sort of, at least in India, stay around. Outside, you know, a lot of the narrative shaped outside is not necessarily only by the scholarly community; it's by mainstream media and it's by the political environment of the time. And I think today's political environment, the way it is shaped by strategic competition between China and the West or the US. And the narrative around 62 also sort of the past also gets shaped in that context. I don't think, and I'm only talking popular narrative. I'm not talking about scholarly discourse. It's shaped in that context. So I wouldn't worry too much in that context. I don't think China gained too much by the selective declassification. You know, even at then that point of time, I don't think it gained too much. So yeah, I mean, I don't see it as a huge issue. But yeah, it would be helpful for the world to understand that if India was to declassify documents, to understand how Indian leaders conceptualized of their sort of strategic environment at that point of time and why certain decisions were taken. Because a lot of those decisions are products of not just politics of the time, but also, you know, strategic sort of situations which are not very dissimilar to today, you know, and that's in large part because you can't change geography. So some of those calculations still exist today. And so it'd be useful to understand that in the past, when some of these situations arose, you know, how did India conceptualize the world? You know, we are again in a place where you're seeing some sort of block confrontation emerging, some sort of it. We are again in a situation where there is this, you know, pentagram of dynamics between Russia, the United States, India, China, and Pakistan. And that is, you know, there is certain resonance with history. So it's useful to understand how was the strategic conceptualization at that time? And are there any sort of similarities? How have things changed, if they have changed at all? So to that extent, to me, it's useful.
Okay, that's almost the time we have, but I have like a, I mean, we all agree that it is very important to have a proper declassification system, and there should be a more easier access to archives, or at least they should be put up online for people to view. So I have a Tartaglia tree proposal, you know, like the US, for example, you have graduation libraries of all the like heads of state. Do you think giving one for each PM of India would like push parties to, you know, like declassify, because at least they'll have some stuff to keep in their libraries? I mean, it's half a joke, but I'm just trying to see, you know, like what could push them.
I mean, I'll just say, just briefly respond to that. I mean, so for example, you did have a one for Nehru, of course, in MML, which still exists, but it's, of course, it's now been renamed Pradhan Mantri Sangrahalaya. And it's supposed to be, you know, Prime Minister Modi said it was supposed to be nation-centric and not person-centric. But anyway, as far as I know, there is no other such collection of papers kept anywhere. And why have one place that houses all the prime ministers instead of having, you know, multiple locations, multiple different libraries that can actually house the papers, you know, house papers, writing, speeches, everything of former prime ministers? I don't think it's a tongue-in-cheek proposal at all. I think it's something that we should have done a long time back. And, you know, it's not just documents on paper. It's radio broadcasts, it's television broadcasts, it's tweets. All of these things are part of the archive and the record of history. And there should be libraries, multimedia libraries that have this, that have a lot of the declassified stuff just online, so that people can go and view it. And, you know, that's the way you can really democratize a lot of Indian history.
Yeah, I agree. I think it's a good idea. And I think, you know, you can actually give every state, from the states from which the prime ministers come, can get libraries. I know that will mean a lot of, perhaps a lot in North India, but at least you can, you know, or maybe that's the sort of cat among the pigeons if I say every state from which prime ministers come, because then you'll end up having over concentration in North India. But yeah, I mean, maybe at least some sort of process by which these libraries are established, and they're established in different parts of the country, because it can also create, you know, it gives attention to developing other amenities around something like this. So yeah, I think it's a good idea.
Okay, I heard it was like half a joke, but I guess it has some appealing from you too. So okay.
Saurabh, what we both are saying is that you can safely remove your tongue from your cheek.
I will do that. So again, thanks a lot, both Manoj and Aditya, for being here. It was a great conversation, and hopefully we see some movement. Somebody hears our podcast in the government and gets a eureka move. So thank you.
Thank you.
Thanks.
If you liked our show, don't forget to check out other interesting podcasts on the IVM network. You can tune into them on the IVM Podcast app, ivmpodcast.com, or wherever you listen to your podcasts. You can also follow IVM on social media. The handle is @IVMPodcasts on Twitter, Facebook, and Instagram. And hey, if you'd like to dive into Takshashila's research on technology, strategy, and economic affairs, check us out at our Twitter handle, @TakshashilaInst, or our website, takshashila.org.in.
Hey, it's been another great week on the IVM Podcast Network. On All Things Policy, Ananya Desai and Rohan Pai discuss recurrent bans on fireworks during festive seasons in India and discuss possible solutions to tackle India's air pollution problem. On the Habit Coach podcast, Ashton Doctor welcomes Sahil Mehta, an esteemed mountaineer and author of the book Break Free. Sahil shares a transformative experience which became the catalyst for embracing discipline and fulfillment. The episode explores the profound impact of vulnerability on personal growth. Folks, if you like our shows, do spread the word. Tell your friends and don't forget to rate and review them wherever you're listening to them. Follow us on social media. We are IVM Podcasts on Twitter, Facebook, Instagram, and LinkedIn. You'll also find all our shows on YouTube at youtube.com/IVM Podcasts. And finally, we would like to thank our sponsors this week: Omidyar Network India, Abbott, IDFC First Bank, and Save Life Foundation. Thank you for making this possible.